You're listening to Pod for Ham, a podcast that's all about the musical Hamilton, taking it one track at a time. Every episode features different groups of interesting people talking about a single track from the original Broadway cast recording of Hamilton. Visit us online at pod4ham, that's the numeral 4, .com. Follow us on Twitter at pod4ham, or you can visit The Incomparable at theincomparable.com.
What comes next? You've been freed. Do you know how hard it is to lead? You're on your own. Awesome. Wow. Do you have a clue what happens now?
Welcome back to Pod for Ham. We have just finished up with the show-stopping, crowd-pleasing, not even the end of the first act, belter, Yorktown. And now there's a very simple question to be asked. What comes next? I'm Chip Sutterth.
I'm Sophie Brookover.
I'm Andy Notko.
I'm Orly Nativ.
And King George is back, and he is not happy. A question that I wanted to ask the panel right from the start is what you think of these sort of interludes where all of a sudden the musical character just completely changes and this guy just sort of waltzes in to comment on the musical and to be really, really funny and then go away for another while. We've already talked on this podcast about his original message to the colonies. What do we think about his note of concern over the direction that this relationship has taken?
I think it's yet another good breakup song. That's really all he's doing. This is the first song is actually, you could almost take it word for word as, oh, you'll be back. You'll realize that we were meant for each other and that everything I was doing for you is because I want the best for all of us. And the fact that they give him the most saccharine, not just British pop, but British like bubblegum pop, the most uncool, unhip style of music that could be anywhere on Broadway right now, let alone inside Hamilton. But now you have the one where it's, the person you broke up with, that was about a month and a half ago, and you notice that there are pictures on their Facebook wall where they seem to be out having fun. And they say, okay, fine. Well, we're definitely broken up now, but now you're going to find out how hard it is, you know, to be in a relationship and to have to deal with the things that I have to deal with, okay? And so don't come crawling back to me. Don't, okay? It's over. Don't humiliate yourself because it's over. You know, that's sort of like half that self-deceptive, like, okay, fine. I thought we could get back together, but now I'm going to take pleasure watching you just fall on your butts.
Basically, yes.
I like that characterization.
And it's notable that, you know, as the one white principal cast member, he basically sings the same song over and over again. It's, you know, same tune, same melody. And he really, just to build on what you said, Andy, he, at the end of the song, the way he really, really hits that final syllable so hard, of "you're on your own," it's like he's auditorily flouncing off. You know, I can just sort of, I haven't seen the show, but I can picture him in my mind sort of turning on his heel, you know, sort of like, I'll show you.
Just in a huff.
That's pretty much what happens. He's even more petulant on stage than he is in the lyrics. When you get to now I'm fighting with France and with Spain, I'm so blue, he petulantly stomps his foot and the stage lighting immediately turns blue.
Oh.
It's very dramatic, but
nice.
What a little boy.
He is such a baby.
You know, there's something kind of fun. He's comic relief, and he's as sort of not even the best comic relief. You're not laughing with him. You're just laughing at him. You're like, you're there and you're grumpy. But he's kind of a meta character. You know, he's the king, but he's just commenting on things as if everyone's hearing it. He's just sort of showing up to have his say. And he's actually really directly inquiring about the show, if you think about it. What comes next? We just got through Yorktown, and what comes next? You know, what comes next is the next song. What comes next are these next actions. What comes next are having to make the country. And almost what comes next is the intermission. You know, it's very real. That just kind of
Are y'all telling me that King George is a human chapter marker?
Yeah.
Yes.
Next on Hamilton, something strange and more awkward.
I really can't wait, as everybody listening to this podcast and participating can't wait to actually see this. And I'm going to have to wait for the touring company to come to Boston. But you've kind of start to leak out what the staging is like. And when you realize that, oh, well, King George is the only character that's sort of like off to the side who never, ever, ever interacts with anybody else, because obviously he's back in England. He's not here. So, yeah, he is sort of like that color commentator on pro football, where he's not playing the game. He is safely in a studio with a microphone and a suit, so he can safely say whatever he wants about the gameplay. Like, wow, that was a bad, bad hit. He's not going to be coming up for another 5 minutes from that one. Like, he's watching all this on television almost.
And he kind of predicts it too.
He does.
Know, there's something really interesting in there. You know, to say nothing of the show, Oceans Rise, Empires Fall is just kind of fascinating, taken in the context of this is, you know, the king saying this.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some way that he also understands? Well, probably not, but it's a great line. And then you get to when your people say they hate you. It's kind of a double line there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just to America.
Yeah.
I think, do you know how hard it is to lead? Mm-hmm. You're on your own. Awesome. Wow. Great line. Do you have a clue what happens now? That's sort of the next segment. I think every segment of the musical between here and the Adams administration is all about how hard it is to, fighting is easy, governing is harder.
Yeah. That awesome wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So good. Can I take a moment to nerd out about accents for a minute?
Please.
So, of course, King George, Jonathan Groff sings King George with a British accent, like a very sort of plummy British accent. And then awesome wow, he hits that in like a very American accent, you know, to be very mocking. But then something he does on the following line, we would probably say it, do you have a clue what happens now? And he says, do you have a clue what happens now? Which is, I think, him sort of tipping his hat to the way that Queen Elizabeth and her husband and children speak. They frequently change their short A to a short E. If you ever hear her say, I'm so happy, she'll say, I'm so happy. And that's an accent that didn't, like, I think that short A becoming a short E didn't really exist then. That was not what was considered like the super duper upper crust kind of British accent. But instead, it would have been characterized by an RLW substitution. Mm-hmm. So that's what was very, very fancy at that time. And I think, unfortunately, there's no way Jonathan Groff could have used that in this accent. It would have seemed unintelligible, I think, to a modern audience. But by co-opting the way that the House of Windsor speaks, at least like that generation of the House of Windsor, he's able to imply like an even more elevated status through the use of his voice, which I think is really interesting.
I love how he is the most anachronistic character.
Yes.
Well, anachronistic is totally the wrong word, actually. Strike that, reverse it. He, unlike all of the rest of the cast, he's wearing pseudo period royalty. He's a white guy. He's speaking with the formal British accent. And then every once in a while, he slips out with an awesome wow.
Right.
Which is the sort of thing that's been happening all over the place with the other characters. 2 weeks later, I'm in my room, in the living room, stressing, you know, stuff like that. But awesome wow, or Jesus Christ, this will be fun, another song from now. I love those moments when the artifice of the old British monarch just slip away and he's speaking to the audience the same way that the rest of the cast does.
And he also punctuates it really strongly when he's singing it. You know, he always even steps even farther into it. Awesome. Wow. He takes that pause. Jesus Christ, that would be fun. You know, he's really kind of chewing on those even more aggressively so that they're very direct commentary that you should really notice he's doing this.
King George III would be awful on Twitter.
What an insufferable jerk.
which means that he'd be great on Twitter. That's right. Part of what's really designed for. It's optimized for that kind of personality. But it's also cool because so Jonathan Groff, one of the King Georges, was on the Colbert Show December, and so he did the King George walk and showed Colbert how to do it, and made the point that at least the first crown that they had for him was like big and heavy, and so a lot of what he was doing on stage is just to keep the crown from falling off, and so he's also the one guy in the entire stage who has this huge ermine red coat and the big shiny hat, and everybody else is in these soft, comfortable clothes that are actually relevant to what's going on the actual stage. That must be the most fun role in the entire cast. I can't imagine anybody in the cast not wanting to look. Can I just understudy Jonathan just for one night, just in case, because I want to wear the hat and I want to do the walk and I want these three incredibly great numbers that everybody loves and everybody. It's probably the one song that everybody can sing in the shower.
Well, and speaking from a costume perspective, because that's what I do for a living, Paul Tazewell is an amazing designer. You also look to a lot of the costumes for the majority of the ensemble. They're sort of stripped down of detail. You know, you see the colors and you see the silhouette and you see the buttons. But this King costume has all the sort of fussy, stuffy little bits of detail and fiddly accoutrement that go with it that come from these paintings and the references of George III, that it's so detail-oriented in this world where things have been kind of reduced and stripped back to their more elemental selves that he stands out even more, to say nothing of the red cape and the shiny and the sparkles. It's just a very effective, I think, design choice for somebody to be, besides that he's the only, you know, white principal character, so directly removed from everyone else. It's very smart.
Did anyone else on their first encounter with the cast album or the musical just sort of wonder why King George was helicoptering in periodically? Or did it take you a while to get how important it is for punctuating the musical?
I think there's so much in this show that you're already rolling with. I didn't find it very removing at all, because the first time he comes in, we have this big context, a message from the king. And then he delivers this song and you go, oh, that's who you are. So when he pops up again, it feels like a reasonably natural, quote, contrivance.
Yeah.
There's a lot of conventions.
Yeah. When I first heard it, I was just enjoying this clever, fun song. So I wasn't thinking that deeply into it. But somewhere around between my 56th and my 73rd listening of the entire album all the way through, I started to wonder, if it was on Miranda's mind that the audience on Broadway is a real white audience. You know, and maybe he's thinking that it's also an older audience, and maybe he's thinking that a lot of these people, I'm going to sort of have to teach them how to listen to these sort of lyrics and how to listen to a story that's being told through this music that they've only ever heard in like commercials for Pop-Tarts, where the animated characters are dressed up and they're doing a Pop-Tarts rap as a cartoon. Some part of me wonders if some of these more accessible songs like this one are kind of intentional, not only to make King George look incredibly like old-fashioned and out of place with the rest of the thing, but to give people the sort of song occasionally that they absolutely have, that the style they've heard before, the style they're comfortable with, certainly the sort of style they might be expecting on Broadway. I don't know if that's true or not, but it did occur to me. I have to admit that I don't have the, I would love to be able to do Farmer Refuted with somebody if I had two people in the shower with me, but I'm not sure that I can actually do the Hamilton part of that without sounding like a real idiot. But I can sing a really bad 1960s British pop song, no problem. Even if it's a tenor role and I'm baritone.
You know, it's a really good, really bad 60s pop song.
It's a catchy, it's the reason why they took over the world, because those are damn catchy pop songs.
Yeah, I don't think those songs are bad at all. I think this is a really good pop song.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a difference between bad and unhip and bad.
That's oh, there, like, you go. There you go.
Yeah. There we go. Unhip to the max.
I just want to, you know, I have to say I'm a little impatient when I hear things like, and I'm not saying that this is your opinion, Andy, but I do get a little impatient when I hear people say that they feel like hip hop is inaccessible. Like, that music has been on our airwaves for 40 years now. Like, it is the greatest American cultural export of the latter half of the 20th century. I don't see it as inaccessible in any way. And I love that Miranda has managed to combine so many different styles of hip hop in this musical and really blend it seamlessly with the other really major musical export of the earlier half of the 20th century, sort of classic American musical theater. Like, I just think, to me, this is absolutely the direction that our musical theater ought to be going in. It just makes perfect sense to me. So I totally get why he has all these different styles. Like, it just shows what an amazing composer he is. I'm ready for this musical to put to bed for once and for all the notion that hip hop is not accessible to a huge, huge, huge audience, because it, you know, record sales don't lie. Like, it clearly is.
I agree with you.
I absolutely agree. I'm glad you pointed out that wasn't necessarily the point that I was making. Only that it's interesting when, like, when he was writing In the Heights, I think that he was writing whatever music he wanted to write. I'm just wondering if, when you think about a musical that might have a broader audience, does that at least get on your mind that there are going to be some people that are going to resist this? And incorrectly, yes, but are there going to be some people that are going to be, oh God, more of this music? I really, really wish there was something with more of a melody. I'm thinking more, not in terms of the music itself being inaccessible. I'm thinking more of some of the discussions that Pixar went through when they were doing WALL-E, that they're saying, okay, well, are we really going to ask people to get this story without having a single line of human dialogue for 30 minutes? Are we asking too much of this audience? Should we have a radio, or should we have distress signals that can still go in? How are people going to react to this, and how are people going to deal with this, given that we're trying to make a movie that could do $200-300 million? So I'm just curious as to if that was even on his mind, or whether it was just, look, the right people are going to be open-minded and are just going to enjoy whatever music they get, no matter if they've heard it or not.
At the time of recording, there was a recent article, an interview with the producer behind In the Heights and Hamilton, where they talked about how In the Heights was marketed as a hip-hop musical, and they feared that was the reason why it didn't last. They think that it could have lasted more years if it hadn't been given that. That's not a pejorative by any means, but it did. They did seem to think that it had wound up limiting their audience a bit. So I think you're both right. I think so, Sophie, you're clearly right that there is nothing that is not mainstream about rap. And you're right. It is the most significant export that we have. And yet, for Broadway audiences, maybe they are still requiring to be helped along a little bit.
Oh, gosh, I'm going to have to chime in here.
Go for it.
Please do.
You know, I think there's an element where the responsibility of good art, of challenging art, of an important piece like Hamilton, like, you know, I think WALL-E is actually pretty important, too, in that, you know, these things are, the decision is made to not coddle your audience, to trust people to make the decision that they are engaging with this piece of work, this piece of art, this piece of artistry, this piece of music on its own merits, because, you know, you bought a ticket. If you don't like it, you leave it intermission. And I think that, you know, the great thing about Hamilton is not necessarily that it's presented in this context of, oh, we're not necessarily marketing it as a hip hop musical. We're marketing it this way and this way and this way. Everyone knows what the show is. You know what the show is, you know what the movie is, you know kind of what you're going to see. And the people that are willing to kind of take the chance on it, especially the producers in tandem with these artists, are doing right, I think, by everyone in making braver choices in order to bring everybody along so that if, yeah, you're used to going to a Broadway show, you know, and you're used to being presented with one thing, well, I think that there's something kind of disingenuous about saying Broadway audiences are all this way out. Broadway audiences want jukebox musicals. Broadway audiences want Les Mis again and again and again and again. And, you know, I think there's something that Lin-Manuel Miranda proves is that Broadway audiences, some of them might really like hip hop. There are people who've been raised on hip hop and musical theater. You know, one who wrote this musical. There are people who've never heard that much hip hop except as it comes over the radio, that sitting here watching Hamilton, listening to the cast recording, suddenly they have a new understanding and it contextualizes it in a way they can reach out again. Or people who know from hip hop and don't know from musicals. So I think there's something kind of overly simplistic in saying, like, this audience is only here to see something and they don't want to necessarily be challenged, and so you should worry about it.
Yeah, that's definitely defeatist as a creator. You really have to make the musical that you have a message that you want to convey, and you just have to make sure that message gets out. Because it's true of absolutely everything that you create. If it doesn't represent your point of view, then it's really of no good to anybody. That's how you wind up with just homogenized milk. You don't wind up with anything with any excitement or that pushes anything forward in any way, shape, or form. It's also true that entertainment is also a little bit of a consumer commodity. That I can only speak for myself. There are times when I will miss out on something great because it's been explained to me in such a way that I don't recognize in it something that I think would be worth my time and my money. Broadway is unfortunately one of these big, terrible casualties where I see a lot more opera in New York these days than I see Broadway musicals, because I know that I can see I can get $25 rush seats at the Met, and I will for $25, for $50, I will take any risk whatsoever. I will see an opera that I've never heard of with people that I've never heard of by a composer I've never heard of, just because it's going to be a new, wonderful, and fresh experience. I wonder. I'm as tired of musicals that are based on popular movies and even popular sitcoms, or there's probably going to be a Kerplunk game musical,
a Battleship game musical.
Insert pejorative comment about Andrew Lloyd Webber and School of Rock here.
Hey, I hear those kids are working hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, who can replace Jack Black? Come on. No one here is judging the people who like are lining up to see those musicals, but I sort of understand why a lot of people don't want to be that adventurous when a ticket costs $150. Boy, I remember when I spent $80 for one ticket, $160 for the pair to see The Producers sight unseen. I bought the tickets the day they went for sale online, because all I needed to know was Mel Brooks is doing a musical based on The Producers. I don't care if it's terrible. I'm going to go see this. But even before I clicked that, I was literally saying to myself, okay, we're putting a lot of pressure on these performers, because for $80, you had better entertain the hell out of me. that's like three CDs. That's a movie, and that's like a $20 dinner. I've actually gone through this about going to see Hamilton, because I was so many of my friends, I don't know about the rest of you, are now that we're at the end of the original cast contracts, and it's possible that this cast
don't
is
say that.
Split up.
Sorry,
if I say it three times in a mirror, it happens. So I've only said it once, and a lot of people are. A lot of my friends are saying, I don't want to spend $500 for like a back row ticket on StubHub, but okay, I'll tell myself that this is going to be like my big treat, and my husband and I it'll be our big like birthday, Christmas, Hanukkah, Thanksgiving gift to each other, because boy, this opportunity is not going to go away. And I'm glad they did it, because their excitement gets shared with me. For me, when it goes up to $500, as much as I love this show, I keep thinking, okay, so let's say that we have $500 to spend for having fun in New York. Now that becomes definitely see buy an actual like full price ticket to the opera, get a hotel room, get a couple of really good meals, go to a comedy club, see a show or two off Broadway where, again, the prices there are low enough that I can just say, this sounds interesting, the cast sounds interesting, I don't know anything about it, but I'm going to go in on it. And that's the point where I say, no, I'd rather spend $500 on 2 days in New York and eight different shows than one thing of Hamilton. So I think it's It must be puzzling, especially when you know that you've got $11 million worth of investors putting their money and their faith in you, to think, are there ways that we can make sure that people like Andy and people other people are not going to be put off by the poster? They're not going to be put off by whatever messaging comes out. Is there a way that we can make sure that someone will say, you know what, I am going to take a risk. I am going to pay $150 to go see this. Without compromising your vision in any way.
I think that, you know, I think there's a few complicated components and issues in it. You know, I definitely agree that Broadway ticket prices in many cases have been, you know, there's a ridiculousness there. Off Broadway, you know, there's something that is really important, I think, that you brought up, is supporting smaller shows coming from off Broadway. You know, this came from the public, which is an off Broadway show, and people took a chance on it there. And I think what's kind of great is sort of the idea of supporting smaller shows as they come up and finding things and taking risks while they're, you know, as a viewer. While things are smaller and you can find out what's next. You know, there is something interesting in thinking about the conflict and the controversy over these super expensive tickets for a show that everybody wants to see, and then hoping that things will be a little more reasonable on the tour or the Chicago production, and that then more people can see it there.
And with any luck, you won't have to be royalty. Yeah. See what I did there?
Well,
to see this in the future.
Can I see one more thing to button that up? Because as sure. It happens, I happen to see The Sound of Music. It's a loyal version to the Rodgers and Hammerstein original version that's on tour. It was in Boston for like 2 weeks, and I got to see it the other day. And it was the first time I'd ever seen The Sound of Music that was not the movie. And if anybody ever thinks that the roadshow version of a musical is, oh, well, they get the high school drama club rejects, and they paint some signs, and they put some slides in the background, and that's it. If you wait to see Hamilton until the roadshow hits your city, you're still going to get an exceptional show with
yes.
some people who spend time.
They
spend
sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And these people are top quality.
In just sort of objective terms, in probably a better theater than the Richard
yes.
Rodgers.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. The theaters across this country that are larger with better seating and plush places than Broadway, you guys.
3,000 seats, the
yes.
Boston Opera House, built in 1911. And oh boy, it was just fantastic. And
so tours are good.
Yeah.
Tours are good. They are what comes next.
Love the tour, you guys.
Yes.
Love it.
Oh, Sophie, it's been a while. Have you any final thoughts about what comes next, the song in particular?
No, I mean, I love it, and it always makes me excited to hear, you know, now that I've listened to the whole thing a bazillion times, it always whets my appetite for what comes next. So looking forward to that episode.
Absolutely. And what comes next is actually Dear Theodosia, with another cast and crew of Incomparable Network panelists here on Pod for Ham. You know, great, great conversation about this track and about a whole lot more than this track. And I really thank all three of you, Sophie Brookover, Andy Anatko, and Orly Nativ. Thank you so much for being part of this panel. I'm Chip Sutterth, and this has been Pod for Ham. Da 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 da. You're on your own.
Are the lyrics different? Like if you're actually seeing the show, like. Go outside, have a drink. We have shirts and CDs all for drinks. Don't take cash, only cards.
In the Richard Rodgers bar.
There's a line to go pee. I'm glad it's you and not to me.